Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show Monday through Thursday at 9 a.m. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Coming up, your letters and the five with Steph Curtis. But first, is the outrage eating us alive? Okay, that question sounds kind of extreme, doesn't it? Just like the simmering anger that seems to accompany us wherever we go these days, including at this Washington, D.C. ballpark. What's all of this moral outrage doing to our brains, to our social fabric, to our sense of well-being? Today, the science and the everyday psychological effects of living with constant moral outrage. And I'd like to hear from you, of course. How do you manage this soup of outrage we seem to be stewing in day in and day out? Is your anger helpful sometimes to focus on issues that need your attention? Or do you find your own anger and the anger of the people around you kind of exhausting? So I want to know how you manage the moral outrage that seems to surround us. Do you find it catalyzing? Do you find it exhausting? Is it sometimes helpful, your own and the anger that you see around you? Is it sometimes helpful to focus on the issues that really need your attention? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. On Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Jillian Jordan is one of our guests. She's a postdoctorate fellow studying psychology and morality at the Kellogg School at Northwestern University. And she's with us today from Chicago. Jillian, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joshua Grubbs is with us. He's a professor of psychology at Bowling Green State University, and he's with us from Bowling Green, Ohio. And Josh, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Glad to be on with you.
Jillian, before we talk about the interesting research that you've been doing on this, I'm really interested in whether you think the quality and the volume of the outrage is different in this era than in other times, and I'm going to cite some other eras in history where we've seemed to be surrounded by moral outrage. But is there something different about it today, or is it more about the fact that we can spread it much more quickly?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think actually the fact that we can spread it much more quickly goes hand in hand with the actual prevalence of outrage. So my impression, and to some degree my research, I think, supports this claim, is that people genuinely feel much more outraged because of the fact that social media has facilitated the spread of outrage expressions. And I think there's actually a lot of data to sort of broadly support that proposal. So I really do think people experience more outrage now as a result of our outrage culture online.
Okay, so both things are kind of true here, Josh. I guess, are we also saying that moral outrage is contagious because of the channels in which we spread it in a way that we haven't seen in the past?
You know, there is certainly research now to suggest that outrage is spread quickly, particularly in online environments. There's quite a bit of research that's come out of Yale over the past few years that has looked at how outrage networks kind of build and expand on themselves via social media, how they kind of reach a fever pitch quickly and then dissipate quickly thereafter.
So that what you just said is interesting there, too. It is moral outrage is perhaps deeper and more widely spread more quickly, but then it fades. I mean, it is not as transformative, I guess, in other times. Is that true?
You know, that's a big question, and I don't know that we have all of the data yet that could really answer that. What I can say is that we know just the nature of social media and how fast the news cycle has gotten.
Yeah.
These outrage phenomena happen quickly, and then people move on to the next quickly. So whether or not it's as transformative or not, it's hard to say. I mean, after all, we see outrage leading to massive protests like the march on Washington after the 2016 election, which that's pretty large and pretty effective in ways that we haven't seen maybe in a generation. So there is some outrage that seems to be sinking deeper, but we do move on quickly as well.
You know, and Julian, I've been thinking about this, and I want to tease this out a little more because, you know, I was thinking about the moral outrage in the 60s over the Vietnam War and how long that took to filter through the different layers of American society to really bring about change, right? It was that sustained moral outrage, I think, that really made change happen, or the moral outrage that occurred more recently when the details of what President Clinton had done with a White House intern, you know, in the Oval Office. I mean, two very different eras in American life, but also a time when moral outrage seemed to be front and center. So does this feel, given what Josh just said about the velocity of the news cycle, does this feel different?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I certainly think outrage moves on quickly in some contexts. It seems like a lot of sort of minor scandals get intense outrage and
right.
people move on to the next thing. I also do think you could make an argument that with respect to sustained sort of movements that people are building, like Me Too, for example, talking about the Women's March, the theme of sort of trying to reform the way this country thinks about sexual assault and harassment and misconduct has been quite sustained effectively
True.
Over a long time. And the different individual cases that people are expressing outrage over are sort of building into something powerful and cohesive. So I don't necessarily think, sort of agreeing here with Josh, that the rapid news cycle is undermining the effectiveness of the outrage in terms of influencing social change or shaping our social norms.
Now, the Me Too is a really interesting, the way you phrase that is really interesting, too, that the overall, this has been a long, long time coming, right? And
right.
the overall outrage has been sustained by more and more examples of it. Here's what Mallory
right.
says on Twitter. Without justified anger, we wouldn't have had the Women's March, Me Too, et cetera. But when we live with it all day long and it's seemingly inescapable, it does get exhausting, which is why it's also important mm-hmm. to turn inward and focus on your mental health. So, yeah, that sustainability and the other side of the coin of that is exhaustion. What do you see in that in your own research, Jillian?
I'm not sure my own research directly can speak to the exhaustion versus the effectiveness of outrage. I totally agree with the tweet you just read in terms of suggesting there isn't a mutual exclusivity between the outrage and the effectiveness in terms of anger fueling social progress and change. My research actually has focused less on the consequences of outrage for our well-being or for social change and more on the ways that individuals are motivated to express outrage.
Ah, like why individuals are motivated to express it.
Exactly.
Yeah. So didn't you also examine this idea of the evolutionary mystery of why we evolved to value moral outrage? And in
yes.
this piece for the Times, you said, we suggest that expressing moral outrage can serve as a form of personal advertisement. People who invest time and effort in condemning those who behave badly are trusted more. I need more explanation. Why? Why is that?
Yeah, so our basic argument is that if you, for example, devote your time and attention to, say, attending a protest for the Me Too movement, this is a credible signal that you really do care about bringing about positive change in society and sort of discouraging sexual assault and harassment. And that reflects that you likely yourself also behave morally, don't engage in these types of behaviors, but maybe more generally have positive moral character. And so it's a credible investment in sort of making your community a more moral place, which sort of indicates that you also contribute to the morality in your community just by yourself being an honest, trustworthy moral person in your own behavior. And then we go one step further, in addition to arguing that people perceive moral outrage expressions and moralistic punishment behaviors as a positive indicator of character, we also wow. argue that this motivates people to express outrage in order to show people that they can be trusted.
Right, because there are rewards for being seen to be morally outraged. Is that right?
That's right.
So, Josh, here's my question about this, though. If there is a societal reward to being seen to be morally outraged, does that mean that some of this outrage is more performative than it is genuine?
You know, that's a good question. Much of the research I've been involved with over the past couple of years in this domain has been focused on kind of the inherent human drive to seek status, which is very akin to what Jillian was talking about there, the notion that we often do engage in certain behaviors in a public way with the hope that we're winning the respect, the esteem, and the admiration of people around us.
Mm-hmm.
So there's kind of two questions here. Is some of the outrage performative, and then also is it genuine? And they're not mutually exclusive. You can genuinely be outraged about something, but also publicly displaying it so that you can signal to others, yes, I can be trusted. Yes, you should respect me. Yes, you should care about what I have to say. So, sure, maybe some of it is performative. It's really hard to know every person's individual motivation for everything that they say, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're not truly outraged at the same time.
I get that. That's really interesting the way you put that, Josh. But I think my skepticism, and I wonder how listeners feel about this, clicks in when I'm seeing constant moral outrage, right? In my view, less is more when it comes to moral outrage. And yet we have these social media platforms that allow people to be morally outraged 18 times a day, which then that's where I question the genuineness of it. What do you think?
Right. So there's this question here of if with so much outrage coming out so often, and when you're so often pontificating about the things that bother you and that really do get to you, is it all that genuine? Does it kind of get, is it lost in the noise?
Yeah.
And that's where some of our research is looking right now. We're trying to figure that out. I will tell you, I've done some work with some philosophers over the past couple of years who very strongly make this argument, this notion that the signal value of outrage is lost when there is a sea of outrage or when there's constant outrage. So, we should be able to use outrage to put forth truly objectionable things, to put forth kind of what we're objecting to, and so that people will recognize that. But if we're always doing it, then that signal is not as valuable anymore, and we can't really pick up on what is as important. Now, whether the research will support this in day-to-day life, I think the jury is still out a little bit, but certainly there are scholars that are projecting that.
So, Jillian, again, to come back to this point for the neuroscientific research of this, the brain is part of the reasons that we indulge in moral outreach is to be seen to be concerned, right? And we've evolved to want to display that. But isn't the brain also receiving some kind of chemical or hormonal reward for being outraged?
Yes, I think the specific neuroscientific claim you just made maybe hasn't been directly tested. There's definitely neuroscientific evidence that people find punishing people they see as wrongdoers to be rewarding.
Okay.
I would actually suggest, though, that evidence that we find it rewarding to express outrage sort of is not mutually exclusive with the possibility that we experience outrage genuinely, and is also supportive of the possibility that we express outrage because we get social rewards to some degree, get social rewards from other people.
Rephrase that, okay? There was a lot there.
Yeah, so I think one reason we may come to find it rewarding to express outrage is because we get social rewards from other people for doing so. So perhaps in the context of Twitter, likes and retweets and stuff like that, but also in daily life we get trusted more by other, praise, gain social status when
Got
we
it.
Express outrage. And I think this can lead to our sense that it's satisfying to express outrage, even if we really experience that outrage genuinely.
Got it. Got it. Jillian Jordan is with us this morning. She's a postdoc fellow studying psychology and morality at the Kellogg School at Northwestern University, with us from Chicago. And Josh Grubbs is with us from Bowling Green, Ohio, where he's a professor of psychology at Bowling Green State University. We're talking about this sea of moral outrage that we seem to exist in. And I think both of our guests have validated the idea that social media platforms really lift that up and make that pretty obvious. My question for you is how you manage this sea of moral outrage that we seem to be stewing in, and whether, and this is going to be interesting to talk to Josh and Jillian about, whether that anger, that moral outrage, is catalyzing in some ways for you to get involved with a cause or focus on issues that really need your attention, or do you find the constancy of this really pretty exhausting? And then I guess we'll be talking about, then does the effect of moral outrage, the good effect of it, diminish because of that? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at @CarrieMPR. To the phones to John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, thanks so much for waiting.
Thank you.
Hi, what'd you want to say?
I want to bring up three names of a sociologist, a journalist, and a neuroscientist that are hitting on this right now in a big way, in a consistent way with books and podcasting. Mm-hmm. Nicholas Christakis at Yale, Douglas Murray, the conservative journalist from Britain, and Sam Harris, who all hit on the possibility that these loud voices, and they really do a good job of focusing in on the campus culture, where young people are sort of ruling the roost now, mm-hmm. Because of things like social media, where in the case of Nicholas Christakis, he was charged with baiting race relations and was confronted by hundreds of students in a courtyard yelling at him, telling him that he was out of line and should be fired. And he was standing there taking it, trying to calm them down to have a conversation. Sam Harris does this as well a lot, where he talks about just in the insanity of where, even especially for him, the left is headed in amplifying these loud voices instead of calming down, taking a very serious look at the situation and having a broader conversation. And I'm just wondering, social media gives us a very short-term platform to air our grievance, mm-hmm. Without much of a face. And instead, we need to look at these people like your guests, these experts that can give us perspective and calm us down so that these conversations can be broader and more nuanced. Because
okay.
It's the lack of nuance that causes these great upheavals
yeah.
in emotion.
Yeah. No, some really good points there. Let's hear Josh on this first. Josh, what do you take from that?
You know, I mean, there's certainly an argument to be made that social media in particular makes it hard to get into nuance, to get into the intricacies of what's going on here. You know, I am a college professor. I spend all year round on a college campus, and I've done that for a decade now. And it's that type of culture, I understand that there's this perception there. I mean, I can say personally that, you know, I haven't experienced very much of it, but it varies from university to university. But what I can say in thinking about these type of things is one of the phenomena I study is similar to moral outrage, is something we call moral grandstanding, the idea that you're performing your moral attributes for other people to kind of respect you. And that's actually not politically loaded. We're not seeing that being more on the left or more on the right. We're actually seeing it associated with extremism on both sides,
wow.
which suggests that it's not just, you know, the liberal college kids or the conservative boomers. It's the people that are the most passionate and kind of the most extreme in their views that are wanting to do this performing for respect and for esteem from others.
Jillian, one of the other things that I pulled out from what John was suggesting was that the nuance gets lost in the stew of moral outrage. And I think it feels like that is true, that you are not bringing your best argument, your best calm, critical thinking when you're immersed in this idea of, in this emotion of moral outrage. And yet I know really important change has happened from these movements that are spurred by moral outrage. What should we understand about that?
Yeah, that's a super interesting question. I mean, I do think there's a potential trade-off to identify between calmness, which potentially facilitates nuance, as has been argued, and also sort of the moral urgency that's conveyed by expressions of anger, which are fundamentally inconsistent with calmness, I think, to some degree. And I think, like, thinking about whether we're trying to see what's happening as a debate or a discussion versus a punishment for something is potentially helpful here. So, I mean, I guess I think if we think of the moral condemnation people express as punishment that's designed to deter transgressions in the future and change the culture and behavior and make people think it's going to be really costly if I transgress in a way that gets me punished, then, yeah, it doesn't necessarily make sense to try and be calm, because that decreases the sort of motivating power of the condemnation in terms of changing behavior. But if we think there really are issues that we want to be discussing, like, I think then calmness and nuance is clearly going to facilitate a more enlightened discussion. So there may be sort of, I think it, when people differ in what they see is desirable in terms of the tenor of discourse, they may be thinking about different goals in terms of sparking social change and having a discussion.
Right. Call here from Gina in Eagan. Hi, Gina. Sounds like you've got some experience with this. What's your story?
Hi. Yeah, thank you so much for having me on air. So I was compelled to become a nurse, specifically a nurse for Medicaid, based mainly on my moral outrage. And I have to say that I think it's kind of being underestimated, because moral outrage is really truly what sparks change. And I think the difference between the moral outrage we see on social media versus what's genuine is, on social media, there's a lot of outrage that's not supported by fact, and it's not really genuine. And that's what really makes, that's what sparks me emotionally, probably the worst. But going back to school, becoming a nurse, and fighting every day in an industry that really needs to be changed is what is pushed by my moral outrage.
Oh, okay, so Gina, you skipped over some bits of the story here, which I think are going to be interesting. You learned something about what, the way Medicaid worked, and you thought, how'd this go?
Yeah, I'll try to sum it up briefly, but basically, I was born a pre-existing condition. So I was born with a heart condition. Uh-huh. I've dealt with the changing environment of health, the health insurance world, from the 80s, and I've seen a lot of negative changes, and I've seen how it has affected not only myself, but people around me.
Right.
And with my second open heart surgery when I was in my early 20s, it motivated me to go back to school to become a nurse. Wow. And then the political advocacy that now comes with being a nurse really kind of stuck with me. And now I work for a company in Minnesota that I work with Medicaid members of Medicaid in Minnesota daily. And I feel like that gives me gratification, but it's that moral outreach that continues to burn that really is pushing me to try to make a difference.
Oh, wow. I really appreciate you telling a bit of that story. Josh, I think this is a pretty unique example of the sustainability of moral outrage over the life of a career. I don't know. What do you hear in Gina's story?
You know, I think that's fascinating, and it's both an interesting and an inspiring story. People that experience an injustice or an outrage, or they see something that's wrong, and then that compels them to move forward over the course of a career or even a lifetime. I mean, there are many examples in history of this occurring. If you think about much of what we saw in the civil rights movement, historically and even more recently, these are phenomena that are often in large part driven by a sense of you know, moral injustice, moral outrage, feeling that there's been a wrong that must be righted. And I don't think that we... I do think that we need to be careful not to dismiss the power of moral outrage in promoting social good. Now, there is this distinction. Again, is it the quickly felt kind of online outrage that moves and dissipates, or is it a sustained sort of, not just an emotion, but it kind of in a motivation and even a goal that people start moving towards to effect this change? And I think that there's probably a qualitative difference between that fastly expressed quote tweet of something you did not like seeing on the internet and the type of thing that motivates you to get up each morning and work towards a different change.
Yeah.
And perhaps they're similar in some ways, but they're also probably quite different in many others.
Yeah, Josh, I was going to say, you mentioned the civil rights movement, the protests against the Vietnam War, Black Lives Matter, Me Too. None of those movements would have gotten off the ground if not for moral outrage. But something, and I'm sure that's a sustaining force, it's a catalyzing force. But then something happens to one of those movements cannot simply exist alone on moral outrage, right? To be sustainable. I think that's kind of an interesting element of the discussion. Do you have a thought on that?
I think that there's a lot of truth to what you're saying there. You know, social movements aren't built on one emotion. They're built on social connections. They're built on belief systems, on emotions, sure, but also with these enduring bonds with others and this overarching desire to see something bigger. I mean, we're talking about values and fundamental social motives when we get into these types of things that extend far beyond outrage. So perhaps outrage starts it, perhaps outrage even helps people as they go along the way, but any social movement is much more complex than a single emotion or a single reaction.
And we're talking about the power and the complexity and the reality of moral outrage. And I'm asking you this morning how you manage this sea or stew of moral outrage that we seem to be living with. Is your anger helpful? I mean, we heard this from Gina. Is your anger helpful to catalyze you to a cause or a movement to focus on issues that are important to you? But are you also finding that the way we live today and the access that we have to this constant moral outrage is pretty exhausting? What do you do with that? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. One of the other things that I want to talk about on the other side of news is the boost that we get from moral outrage that becomes shaming. Oh, we had a really interesting show on this months and months ago, but I want to ask Jillian and Josh about that. And I wonder if there are some personality traits that really contribute to people who find themselves morally outraged more often than the rest of us. Okay, all that on the other side of news. To Phil Picardi now. Hi, Phil. Jillian Jordan with us. She's a postdoc fellow studying psychology and morality at Northwestern University. And Josh Grubbs is a professor of psychology at Bowling Green State University. Jillian, can I put that personality trait question to you? Have you seen some study, done some research on this? What do we know about it, if anything?
Yeah, so from my understanding, this is actually an excellent question for Josh, but I'll
take a whack at it.
I think the one thing that's interesting is that moral outrage can reflect essentially an aggressive motivation or also a moral motivation. And so I think this is part of why it can be difficult to discern how genuine or how virtuous somebody actually is. If they're expressing moral outrage, they could be truly somebody who cares about the moral issue and has conviction and they're trying to make the world a better place, or they could enjoy sort of hurting the person they're condemning and bringing them down and trying to feel aggressive and powerful. And so I think that's sort of an interesting feature of moral outrage relative to other types of moral expressions. But also, I think, Josh has directly studied actually personality correlates of moral grandstanding. So
Josh, talk to me about those personality correlates. I'm interested in that.
So I do quite a bit of research on personality traits and how personality traits predict behaviors and those sorts of things. And it does fundamentally kind of come down to the type of outrage that's being expressed. So outrage is an emotion. And if it's outrage expressed with the goal of hurting or demeaning or attacking someone else in a way that causes them shame,
mm-hmm.
you're looking at traits that we consider more antagonistic. So we're talking about things like higher levels of entitlement, higher levels of exploitativeness. So essentially narcissistic traits. So I'm not saying that people that, you know, are outraged are narcissists. I'm saying that people that are attacking others with the goal of causing them pain, with the goal of causing them shame, are probably, you know, exhibiting more of these antagonistic traits that we associate with things like narcissism. Now, if the goal of your outrage, though, is to promote social change, if it's to promote a social good, if you're in this kind of situation where you're not really trying to hurt anyone so much as you're trying to advocate for someone else, you're probably not going to see those antagonistic personality traits coming into play. We're going to be seeing, more than anything, things like extroversion, just kind of the ability to go out there and engage publicly with others and to have this kind of social persona that might be predicting some of it. And that association is even going to be a bit smaller than what we would see with that antagonism and that harmful targeted
outreach. Got it. I want to play something that is believed to have ignited the Tea Party movement. And I want to hear where you two put what you've just described here. This is Rick Santelli on CNBC in 2009. Here's the rant.
How many of you people want to pay for your neighbor's mortgage that has an extra bathroom and can't pay their bills? Raise their hand.
How about we all?
President Obama, are you listening?
Josh, what, I don't know if you were aware of that before you heard it today. Where do you put that in what we've been talking about this morning?
Oh, that's interesting. I'm vaguely aware. I was still an undergrad back in 2009, so I wasn't paying as much attention as maybe I am now. But
yeah.
There's certainly some targeted kind of outrage there. You know, there's a question of genuineness anytime we're dealing with this kind of performative political outrage from public figures. Genuineness is always a question, whether it's just, you know, playing to their audience or if it is genuinely felt. I will say that the way that that was targeted, it's clear that it was meant to capitalize on animosity towards an individual and build that into a bigger movement.
Jillian, what do you think?
I agree with what Josh said there. I think it's also just interesting when outrage is sort of directed at the true source of animosity versus the sort of post hoc construction of outrage to facilitate expressions of animosity towards someone that maybe are rooted in something else.
So wait. What are you saying there?
I guess what I'm saying is, like, it's interesting in that anecdote to think about, are the factors being listed what caused animosity towards Obama, or does animosity towards Obama then sort of lead to finding rallying points to try and express aggression that was already there? And so I think that can also be an interesting question in the context of outrage directed at a political figure that people oppose.
As it happens, President Obama has been recently talking about what he calls the cancel culture, where he talks about this moral outrage that we seem to be surrounded by. Let's listen to what he said.
This idea of purity and you're never compromised and you're always politically woke and all that stuff, you should get over that quickly.
Josh, what do you think he's saying?
You know, it's an interesting idea, and I think that, you know, Obama is joining the larger chorus of many politicians calling for more civility in all levels of discourse. You know, cancel culture is a fascinating phenomenon that in some ways is driven by outrage, in some ways is probably driven by other things as well. And, you know, I think, sure, there are times that we should have a more tempered approach to how we do things, and there's probably times that people that are quote-unquote canceled, maybe that's not a bad thing. I think it's a double-edged sword.
Call here from Dusty in Hastings. Hey, Dusty, thanks so much for waiting. I know it's been a while, but I'm glad you hung on.
Okay.
What'd you want to say?
So I have three questions. I'll try to be concise. But my question to the researchers is how – it seems like this moral outrage is a precursor potentially to mob mentality, which is very dangerous and scary. So mm-hmm. have you noticed an increase in that?
Okay.
And also the accuracy of mob mentality. So a lot of times during mob actions or riots, you know, places get destroyed that, you know, the corner store gets destroyed that shouldn't have been. So do those type of things happen more?
Okay.
And then thirdly, in the religious vacuum of less religious, is that partially to blame for this more outrage?
Hmm. Okay. Josh, on the mob mentality, what would you say?
You know, I think there is certainly research to suggest that moral outrage and mob mentality share similar features. I mean, we know that groups of people like to bond over strong emotional experiences, and that under the influence of those strong emotional experiences, all sorts of behaviors may seem justified. And that can certainly account for outrage. Outrage can be part of that. You might actually see that with positive emotions as well. And I actually want to speak a little bit to the religious aspect. So my background before I got into all of this was in the psychology of religion and spirituality. And the reality is people often do want to have a meaning-making system around which they orient their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think outrage is a meaning-making system, but I think that outrage is often part of any meaning-making system. If you look at any world religion, we see outrage as a part of it. You know, that is part of how religions work, is they tell you what you should love and be passionate about and celebrate, but they also tell you what you should be angry about and destroy.
Yeah.
And so I don't think it's the absence of religion. I think outrage is a human emotion, and religion has used it, but other social movements use it as well.
We have a pastor actually on the line here, and I'm curious about what he thinks of this. Hi, Gordon. Good to have you on the phone.
Hi.
Yeah. Can I ask what you think about that last point that Josh made?
Well, I think love is the ingredient here that we're kind of overlooking. I'm pastor of a Swedenborgian church, the only one in the upper Midwest. And it was a little church over in St. Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And our doctrine is informed by Emanuel Swedenborg's theological works. He was a 18th century scientist and theologian. And what he says about this is that there's a difference between extreme anger or outrage, which involves animosity and hatred of the other, and zeal, which is the same a sense of need to change something, but it involves loving the neighbor, as the Lord informed us that we were to do. So I think this difference between zeal and outrage involves whether we love one another and want to cooperate, or whether we hate each other and just want to have our way.
Huh. Josh, I'm going to bring that back to you, since your studies have included spirituality in this.
You know, the psychological study of love and how that motivates us in various capacities has been going on for decades and decades now. And it's complex, and it involves emotions and motivations and social drives in ways that may be even more complicated than moral outrage discussions are. So speaking to how that motivates us, I think, is a big question. It's a big domain to try to address. But I will say this. We do know that positive emotions, that compassion, that empathy, that connections with other humans can be powerfully motivating causes as well. And we also know that being connected with the humanity of someone else makes it less likely that they're going to be the target of your extreme outrage and aggression. So there probably are ways that you can be very upset about the injustice of something
mm-hmm.
while still being connected to the humanity of the person that committed that injustice
mm-hmm.
and expressing that in a way that maybe is less toxic and more constructive. Now, there's probably times that that connection to the humanity is not necessary for social change, but there's certainly times that that connection to your ideological opposite's humanity is a good thing to keep in mind as you're moving forward.
So, Jillian, this question comes from what Josh was just talking about. I wonder if the more we dial up the constant outrage, the less effect that true, you know, that genuine moral outrage has on making change. As in, if everybody's out, you know, if we're constantly outraged, then really nothing is effective because there's no spectrum, I guess. Does that make sense? Yeah.
I mean, I think that's a super interesting question. I think, we don't really know. This is something that would need to be researched, but you could ask, is the consequence of outrage less positive for changing future behavior in a positive direction if there's more outrage? I think one other thing you're suggesting that is also an interesting question that I actually may be a bit skeptical of is that we're no longer distinguishing the amount of outrage we express about things that are more versus less bad. That's definitely an intuition that we might get from social media, but also I'm personally a little skeptical that that's true. I think people do still see differences in magnitude between some cases that get discussed and other cases that get discussed. And I think the really interesting question for science is are we sort of doing enough to distinguish between more versus less extreme cases such that our outrage is particularly reforming the most egregious behaviors? And I think it's totally plausible that that is becoming less true due to the volume of outrage, and also plausible that it's not true. And so I think that's an exciting direction for researchers as well.
This is just fascinating research that you two are doing. Thanks so much for being on the show to share it. Josh, really appreciate it. Jillian, thank you so much. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. You can learn more about our show by searching for NPR News with Carrie Miller.